You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com. Welcome to We Are Libertarians, where our goal is to help you sound smarter while talking with your friends. I am so excited to be back again. We're doing another episode of The Swamp Explained, and I've had a flaky month, and thankfully Rob Cortell has been after me to do an episode, and there has been a lot that has changed. Now, if you're not familiar with The Swamp Explained, I am joined by Rob Cortell, a 45-year fly on the wall of Washington, D.C., and he's worked for Republican presidential campaigns, government agencies like the EPA, and has been confirmed by the Senate to the U.S. Maritime Commission. He's also a candidate. He was a candidate for Congress and Senate. He's also spent years working in the private technology sector, working with startup companies. Now, given all of this experience and his iconoclastic viewpoints, he gives us great insight into the swamp and what makes up our nation's capital. And I have been fascinated by Washington politics since I was a boy. And I love it.
Boy, are you sick?
I'm a sick I am one sick puppy, Rob.
Yeah.
And
I suffer the same disease. We must be contagious.
Yeah. And
you should wear masks.
I can't think of a time crazier than the last month since we last were together talking. I think we were talking about Justin Amash had gotten into the race. Well, he dropped out. And then,
right.
You know, Joe Jorgensen won the nomination. And then, you know, Donald Trump seemed like he was kind of getting the coronavirus stuff under control, and Democratic governors were praising him, and you started to go, maybe he can pull this out, you know, maybe he's starting to figure out the job. And then all hell has broken loose. We've got an all number of things to talk about. We've got John Bolton to talk about. We've got the church incident. We've got the protests and his response to that. We've got what else has gone on? The Supreme Court. There is a ton of stuff that has happened, and the presidential race is starting to heat up. So,
lots of illustrations of the swamp at work.
Just
good and bad, good and bad.
Yeah, and then the firing of the attorney general firing the prosecutor going after Rudy Giuliani, which weirdly puts in the role of the fired prosecutor a person that convicted Roy Cohn. So,
right.
so the woman taking over that particular post in the Justice Center put
72-year-old woman, very capable. Yep.
Put away Roy Cohn, Trump's original lawyer, and the guy that he wants Bob Barr to be. So all very interesting.
And the guy that who was fired was the guy who Trump himself put in after firing his predecessor.
Was that Preet Bharara that was fired before?
Yeah.
So, as you've been watching the news, you've been around for a long time watching this, been involved, been in front of the Senate. Like, what have just been in your impressions of Trump and politics over the last month?
Well, you know, so the swamp is, I think you and I have determined it's a good thing and a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the unfortunate aspects of the Trump presidency is that when he was trying to go after the bad elements of the swamp, he's really failed because he hasn't put people in the right place and hasn't put the right people in the right places, put them in the wrong place. And so he has no control over what goes on.
Right.
Some things, fortunately, I just have to tell you, one of my friends, we were doing a Zoom with a friend, and he stood up and he had a Cuomo Fauci for president t-shirt.
Boy, that didn't last very long.
No. So I think the big loser is probably right now is Bill Barr.
Mm.
You know, we can talk about the walk in the park, and we can talk about this fiasco, you know, in the Manhattan, you know, federal prosecutor's office and all that. But, you know, Barr, he's generally been viewed around town as a good guy, intelligent guy. He is a product of a conservative, you know, education and everything else. But he's been a major member of the establishment. And maybe the establishment's kind of the fertile ground for the swamp. But he's two things this week. In the last 2 weeks, you can kind of finger him for. One is mishandling of the prosecutor deal. Apparently the deal there is that because the prosecutor had been appointed under an interim appointment or some such thing, he could only be fired by the president. He could not be kind of relieved by the attorney general. And since he would not turn in a resignation, he had to be fired. So all of a sudden, the president has to fire him. Barr had to go get him to do that. And I suspect he didn't want him to do that for all the reasons we know, the media and everything else. So that was a screw up on Barr's part. And then the park, you know, I have some friends who were in D.C. at the park when the police started charging and doing the tear gas canisters. And it appears that it seems there were a couple things that were true. First of all, Barr claims, and I'm willing to take his word for this, that he had issued an order earlier in the day for the park to be cleared, and they just did it without thinking about the curfew and everything else. I don't know if that's technically true or not. It appears that the people doing the clearing were not necessarily the people trained in crowd control. So it was the park police and others like that. Now, the park police deal with crowds, but I can't remember the last time the park police had to deal with a riot or anything like that. And then Barr went on to say that tear gas, that the pepper spray was not chemical. And I have to admit that I did not know that pepper spray was chemical. I'm not surprised that, you know, I sort of figured it was some kind of natural capsicum or something. But, I read the Post like everybody else in the Times, and obviously it is chemical. So he was probably ignorant like I am. But, you know, that was just a screw up. And the fact that they brought the generals in who had to turn around and apologize, and the Secretary of Defense who had to turn around and apologize in order to maintain their personal integrity and with the people they work for, and frankly, their constitutional duty to remain above and out of civilian affairs. I think Barr is the big loser on this, and I suspect it will resonate in town, in D.C., among people who know him well. And then Barr and that crowd also picked Gorsuch, and they've done two picks now for the court, and everybody's hoping, they're hoping that somehow Bader Ginsburg is going to, Ginsburg is going to retire or something. I think she's going to go down with a ship.
Oh, at least one. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of a ghoulish.
She's going to wait.
It's such a ghoulish tradition that goes on both sides. Oh, like,
of course.
You know.
But so this week, you know, Gorsuch writes the opinion on LGBTQ that it's covered in under the law, non-discrimination. You know, it's about sex.
Essentially now, adding to the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, now I think it was
LGBT.
Kind of a tortuous. I'm happy they did it. I'm happy that you can make a tortuous argument in either direction, I suspect. It was. I'm happy he ruled that way, and he was joined by John Roberts, which sort of makes it, you know, okay with the establishment and gives a fig leaf. But who picked Gorsuch and these guys? It was the society and Barr and all these guys.
The Federalist Society, yeah.
Federalist Society, and you know, he's all part of that deal. So if I were worrying about my job this week in Washington, I'd who would that be? I'd probably be Bill Barr.
Yeah, and, well, the
room. And he's kind of a straight-up guy, you know. He just...
Is he? Because I get serious Dick Cheney vibes when I watch him interviewed.
I don't think he's Dick Cheney. First of all, I don't know if he's quite as smart as Dick Cheney. But he is a very intelligent guy. And he's had a good reputation. But, you know, these are some major screw-ups. And he's, in my opinion, he's kind of... He should be thinking about the next job. Maybe he'll hang around till the election and do his thing then.
Would it be possible that he'd add to the list of people that Trump fires, and then, you know, between now and election day, he joins Rex Tillerson and Mattis and Bolton and joins the chorus of this guy's not fit to be president?
No, I think he's like a lot of these guys in the administration, and women too. By guys, I mean men and women, you know, who have decided that there's something underlying here that they're working for, that they need to, that they just have to hold their nose and do it and work for Trump. And, you know, my wife at the beginning of all this, right after the election, said, like, who would ever work for Donald Trump? And I said, anybody the president asks will do it for God and country kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they do. And it's a good thing. You would hope that good people would work for people you don't like on behalf of the country. And they're not all good and they're not all perfect and everything else. But I think it's going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah, so this is a tension that I was thinking about today as I watched the hour-long interview with John Bolton, here's a person that I have absolutely no love for in terms of ideology. Yeah. I mean, but when you listen to his critique of foreign policy in this interview, I couldn't disagree with him more. But when you listen to his critique of Donald Trump, the man and the president, you go, there isn't any arguing with, like, my eyes match what this man is saying about his administration. Right. And you get the sense in listening to that, and this is the tension that I think populists or libertarians or progressive, left progressive people who are not friendly with the establishment necessarily, they look at it and they go, well, there shouldn't be an establishment. There shouldn't be a swamp. There shouldn't be that continual bureaucracy. It should be an ever-evolving door. Whereas when you watch John Bolton, he has spent a lifetime building this system, wants to protect this system, knew what he was getting himself into, but thought he had the hubris that he could stop the train wreck that is President Donald Trump, and he couldn't. And now he's left without
friends. There are two things that are true in what you're saying. Although it's not the ever evolving door, it's the ever revolving door.
There's no evolving here.
no evolving door here. I can't say that the swamp, that there's much evolution in the swamp.
Yeah.
Bolton, and I do think an awful lot of these guys are convinced that, you know, if they're there, they're going to save the republic. They can save the president. Everyone thinks they're smarter than the president.
That's why Mike Pence took the job, by the way. I mean, that's, you know, from his mouth to my friend's ears. I mean, he thought he could wrangle him.
Oh, they all do. And he's unwranglable. And of course, you remember when he said, I can be very presidential. What he meant by that is he thinks of the presidential model as Putin.
All right. So
he can be very much like that. But Bolton, I've never been a fan of Bolton's either. I do think that Trump aptly described him when he quit, which was he always wants to go to war.
Yeah.
And I'm paraphrasing, of course, but, you know, Bolton is a hawk all the way. And you know, I think a lot of people voted for Trump on the basis he was going to get us out of all these places. He was going to get us out of Europe. He's going to get us out of Korea. I mean, why the hell are we still there kind of attitude? And there are reasons we are there, and you can argue about that. But there is a kind of fatigue with Americans being everywhere on the planet and the kind of American adventurism. And it's all cloaked in foreign policy stuff, saving this person and that person and that society and protect our interests. And it is all of those things and none of those things. So Bolton came in, and his instincts are diametrically opposed to Trump's. He just doesn't. That is not his instinct. And so I am not surprised he and Trump didn't get along. I'm surprised he stayed as long as he stayed. I don't think he's a particularly meritocratic guy when you, in terms of this book, he obviously was taking notes the whole time so he could make sure that he would come out smelling like a, well, I'm not sure he came out smelling like a rose, but
no, but, I mean, did you watch most of the Sunday shows or did you see the interview?
Yeah, I saw most of them. Yeah. I saw part of the interview.
There wasn't one Democrat that said anything nice about him. There wasn't one Republican that said anything. It was really interesting to see this guy who, you know, is just sort of a moderate Midwesterner watching these shows. I go, man, what this guy say, what he essentially said in the interview that was pretty damning against Trump, which confirmed what we all know to be true, is that he's not intellectually curious. They would have to explain the same thing over and over again. He would, for instance, the 1954 line with the DMZ between North and South Korea, they had to explain why that existed over and over and over again. He just reacts, you know, he's just a... Yeah. He is more...
But he's transactional. He is very transactional. That's what that is.
There is less of an intellect there than I thought based on what Bolton was saying. And you know, Trump is a genius at getting attention for himself, but when you hear Bolton explain Donald Trump, it takes the 8D chess theory and throws it out the window. This person is just completely in it for his own reelection. He said, Martha Raddatz said, you know, it's been said he doesn't have an attention span. And Bolton said, that's true. He has almost no attention span for being president. But when it comes to how it relates to his reelection, he has an infinite attention span. How things right. relate to him.
Well, he doesn't want to be seen as a failure. Doesn't want to be the guy who right. loses the election. So everything is focused on that right now.
Yes.
But I'm just going to tell you again, though, a lot of Bolton's criticism, if you can stand back and you take Bolton's name off of it and you take Trump's name off of it and you get right down to positions, just to positions, the public will have a lot of the same point of view that Trump did. Mm-hmm. Even on the left, which is this whole issue of why are we still there? I was struck by one of the things Bolton said that, you know, I knew that talking to the Koreans was hopeless. I mean, that was and would undercut us. Well, sure, it's hopeless. But is it better to talk or not to talk?
Right.
And I think a lot of the public kind of feels like that. And it's the same thing with the Israelis and the Palestinians. Is it better to talk or not to talk? You know, Dennis Ross, who I've known 35 years, 40 years, has, you know, he talked to him for 30 years and still no solution. So I'm glad to have somebody else talking to him now, even if it's Jared. And Bolton does represent a wing of the establishment of the foreign policy establishment of the United States. So he is a consummate swamp creature. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I mean it in the broad sense of, you know, we have this swamp and there are people and things who live there. And sometimes it's good that they do what they do. And sometimes it's not. So
You nailed it on the head, though. It is, as you watch it, that's exactly the critique. As you watched him defend the institutions, you're just like, yeah, but you're wrong. Donald Trump is right. terrifying as president, but what he says and what he, some of what he does, you're like, some of what he says, you're like,
some of what he does.
I kind of like, yeah, I'm anti John Bolton. I get where I agree with Donald Trump on this, but like I talked to my dad this weekend and he goes, I watched that rally Friday night. I've never heard a president say that many cuss words, listed all the cuss words he remembered. He goes, he's so grotesque. What an awful human being. But man, my business can't afford Joe Biden. I'm just gonna have to hold my nose and vote for Donald Trump because he's right on these issues. And I think that's a lot of the calculation where people will be.
Well, and of course we have my friend who was visiting us this week. I can't give you all the details, but is very heavily involved in around polling and other stuff. He's not working with a presidential campaign or anything like that, but he is deeply mired in all of that. You know, he's insistent when you look at the polls that Trump's base is walking away and everything else. And I have to say, when I look at these polls, including the Fox poll and the one that had Biden 55 to 43, and, you know, it's startling, but I am not convinced even that shows that Trump is going to lose. I think consistently these polls are leaving out anywhere between 8 to 12, 13% of the voters who express no opinion. Some percentage are coming off of Trump. And I think they'll go back. And, you know, Biden is not very inspiring at the moment. And I think reminding people how wrong they were isn't going to get them very far. I mean, we have this conversation among several of us about the use of the term racist versus unconscious bias, you know, which, by the way, is a term they use. They use the latter in education. The language you use is very important. There's nothing that Biden says and so far that is terribly inspirational to make people want to vote for him. It's all anti. But I just don't think, and I'm, you know, of course, I'm following the polls, you know, in the key states and Real Clear Politics and everything else. And you need to look to see if it's likely voters. B, you need to look to see how many are undecideds or express no opinion. And when you do that, it's still murky at the edges. You know, Trump can lose by probably 6-8 million votes and still win the election because half of those are in California alone and the other half are in New York. So,
yeah, I learned my lesson in 2016 not to follow 538 for all my political information, and I've spent a lot.
That's because it was probabilistic, not because it wasn't informed. It was probabilistic.
Yeah, and so what I've tried to do now is talk to a wide variety of people, and I got my hair cut on Saturday, and this guy's not a Republican.
Yeah, and you're looking pretty nice.
Thank
there.
You. He's a blue-collar guy, not a Republican, and he goes, I'm going to paraphrase what he said, but, you know, I think of things in nuance and try to break this stuff apart for people, but you don't remember that most people just view the news as flat and it's all connected. And he said, you know, I was out of work for 2 months. They didn't get to my unemployment until I could go back to work. So I didn't get unemployment. I was out of work without income for something that was, I'm not going to call it a hoax, but it didn't seem that serious. I feel bad for all those sick people, but I'm sitting here wondering why I didn't get paid for 2 months. And then I turn on the news and see all these people out there protesting, and it's okay for them to go out, but I'm not allowed to go to work. Then when I see the people who are protesting on my behalf, they're the villains, and Donald Trump's the villain, and then they're tearing down founding father statues, and I just have to start, and he goes, I just have to start to wonder, like, at what point do I start to think this is all really a Soros thing? You know, and that's the level that people kind of look at this stuff. They think of it in flat terms. It's all connected. The shutdown goes into the Bill Gates pandemic, you know, and so it's, I think anybody who thinks that Donald Trump is guaranteed a loss is not paying attention to the resentment that a lot of people who are not even MAGA people, just regular people, they see the hypocrisy on the news around the pandemic and rallies. They see founding fathers, like the Teddy Roosevelt statue is gross, and I'm okay with it. Like, if you look at the statue, you're just like, take that down. But the reality is most people look at that and they see it as an attack.
Reality is he was a progressive.
Yes, he was a eugenicist. He was a gross person. Or they see Grant being torn down. And they're willing to listen on Confederate statues, but once you start tearing down Caesar Rodney and Founding Father statues, that's when it's a bridge too far. And they go, maybe Donald Trump is right about the leftist horde coming to invade my Applebee's.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and you opened the program by saying that you just thought it was an incredibly contentious period, and I do think it's that. However, we've talked in some of these other episodes about back in the '60s. So I went to high school. I grew up. I went to college in the '60s. I went to college in 1968. You know, we had race. We had race riots. We had political riots. We had Vietnam riots. We had daisies and rifles and blood on walls and bombings. I think there were some 300 and some bombings in the South in black churches over that period that you don't read about, lynchings. And I will tell you that many of us thought the world was somehow going to come to an end. And it did not. The parts of the government just work. Social Security checks go out, healthcare checks get taken care of, the roads get built if they ever fund them. So these are all the parts of the swamp that you really want to kind of work. It's the political class that are the showboats of the swamp that are the problem all the time. Is this different or better or worse in the 60s? We haven't had any assassinations. Remember Kennedy and Martin Luther King and others before that and during that. So who knows? Maybe we will yet, but I hope not. Those things are pretty disturbing. I think the public is very engaged in ways that are relatively constructive right now. You know, I think the fact that businesses are by and large trying to figure out their way through COVID, which is hugely difficult, trying to find their way through Black Lives Matter and all of that. And of course, now there's, that's actually a good case of bureaucracies and training and things that they really need to hop onto. You know, everybody's right. Not all cops are bad. Actually, they ought to say it more favorably. probably 90% of 95%, 98% are all good. But as in everything with big numbers, there are always people who are off the reservation and people who don't interpret what they're trained correctly. So, you know, like Black Lives Matter, just in the cop part, I think they've got to completely restart the way they train police in this country. We've gone, there's too much kind of military uniforms and SWATs and all those kinds of things. And that's changed attitudes and the shoot to kill. And
did you always feel that way, or have you evolved on that? I mean, as you've...
No. Okay. I've felt that way probably for 15 years in the cops. I've never been a fan just because they, you know, I watched the Washington, D.C. cops. I've never been fond of them. A lot of people are terrific. And I should just underscore, I've never been arrested for anything. So, but I think there's a kind of brusqueness and rudeness that creeps in over a while, and they're very hard jobs. But, you know, back in the Reagan administration, I worked with a guy named Adam Walensky, who was Bobby Kennedy's chief speechwriter, and he later became a police commissioner in the city of New York, and very successful and a great guy. He's probably in his late 70s or early 80s by now, but he came up with the idea of the what they called the police corps, which was the idea like ROTC, that you would give college kids a tuition in exchange for 4 years in police. And they would receive training in the summers, just like you do in ROTC. And I tried to get George Bush. That was the middle of, that was in probably 82. And I was in charge of Florida, and Kathleen Kennedy Townsend was in charge of Maryland. And it was quite an interesting crowd of people. And a great idea, and Bush was going to do it, and then your favorite Dick Cheney sort of – oh, no, it wasn't Dick Cheney. It was OMB shoot.
Mitch?
No. I'll think of it in a minute. It was – I can see his face. Dick.
Rumsfeld?
Dick Darman.
Oh, okay.
Kind of killed it, and it was on the basis of we're going to win. We don't need one more issue. So that must have been 88 that was 88 because he was going to win and he did. And then Clinton did a version of that. But so I've been up close to the police too, and they have very hard jobs, but this is one where we really have to rethink the entire structure of how we train and manage and all of that. And, you know, that's a bureaucracy and a part of the swamp that really needs to be kind of upended a little bit, but so
yeah,
I don't know how I got on that, but
no, I think that's perfectly reasonable. I mean, to me, so I watched 60 Minutes last night. I've officially reached the age where yesterday was Father's Day. I'm not a father, but I did grill out twice and watch 60 Minutes and mightily enjoyed it. And they interviewed the head of the Minneapolis Police Department, who once sued the MPD for racism. And the guy that he sued is the head of the unions, which was crazy. And, you know, he went through a lot of different reforms and talked a lot about how things have improved in Minneapolis. And one of the things that he did immediately upon taking the office was start cutting low-level drug offenses. And to me, the war on drugs, I think we've run out of gas on that. Like there is no, in the millennial generation, especially, there is no tolerance for the war on drugs whatsoever. You look at the opioid epidemic, you look at pot and how things have not de-escalated. You watch these documentaries, seeing like The House I Live In is one of the best documentaries ever. And you see the systemic problems. That seems to be the tip of the spear in what we need to reform.
All the other things they have to do. So they have to respond for domestic violence. You got some 6-year-old kid in a first grade acting out and having a tantrum, and they call the cops for that. That's crazy.
Homeless.
You know, this has really that has to stop. So we have to decide what is essential. And you know, some cities are doing things like, rather than if someone calls about domestic violence or something else, they now send a counselor out to the house instead of, or with a cop rather than, you know, what they do. So So that's an area that I suspect we'll see an awful lot of attention paid to, and it needs to be paid to it. But
yeah, I totally think it makes sense to. I'm not an abolish the police type libertarian. I look at breaking it apart and go, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
So what are some other things that have stood out to you? I mean, you mentioned the judges, and I thought that was an interesting. Maybe here's what I'd ask you. But Gorsuch was the rationalization from conservatives to libertarians forever, saying, right. You know, but Gorsuch, look at this great justice. Now the argument back is but Gorsuch. And there are some libertarians who look at what he wrote in the LGBT opinion, for instance, and liked it, and then some that didn't. It depends on, you know, do you like the Mises Institute or not? but when you look at Trump's performance overall, he's constantly kind of undercutting himself. And
yeah,
I think the thing that has stood out to me over the last, since we last talked over the last month, is first the willingness to dominate, the use of the word domination, wanting to put 10,000 troops out on the street,
right.
You know, and then the willingness to lie, just like this rally in Tulsa was, like, it was schadenfreude for everybody because he cares so much about the vanity and the crowd size. And, like, they had these million tickets, which a bunch of teenagers, like, bought these tickets.
So it's like TikTok.
Yeah, TikTok.
TikTok
teens buying tickets to bamboozle the Trump campaign, troll him back. He walks out a defeated man. He had 6,000 people there. Nickelback had sold 7,000 tickets the year before. You know, it. And so everybody's just kind of laughing at this.
I think it was 16,000.
Oh, was it? Okay. Yeah. Either way, it's hilarious because it's just like...
It's a long ways away from a million.
It everybody sort of got a good laugh out of it. And then you see people on your Facebook timeline parroting what Brad Pascal, who I think will be fired before Bob Barr...
I agree with you.
Basically saying it was the protesters, the violent leftists were preventing people from entering the arena. There's no video of it. There's no photographic evidence that thousands of people were denied entry. You'd think that there would be some photos or video of it. There wasn't. And
well, you have to ask what Fox is showing, though.
Right. It's literally just pure propaganda from a politician being spit back at myself on Twitter and Facebook. And you just go, can you find some evidence? And they can't, but they still believe it. And it's the intention. It's the most egregious lie that is provably
false.
But
here's your problem, Chris. Forever.
Yes.
This is your problem. Mm-hmm. You want to be evidence-based.
Yeah.
Evidence is irrelevant these days.
Yeah.
I mean, it's irrelevant to people about the contagion, you know, COVID. Right. Is it contagious or not? It's irrelevant as to whether there were people demonstrating out of the other side there. It's kind of irrelevant to a lot of people that on the walk across the park, whether who did what to whom. I mean, facts are sort of just not relevant anymore.
If you aren't personally experiencing it, it's not happening, and everyone else is lying because you didn't experience it.
That's right. Yeah. It's inconsistent with your self-image. Now, as I think I told you a couple months ago, I saw myself in a video, and I'm asking myself, who's that old guy with a fat pot? And I decided that was inconsistent with my self-image, and I've now lost 22 pounds. But so
yeah, you look great.
Thank you. So sometimes, you know, being inconsistent with the facts is a good thing.
have you ever, I mean, is this just politics and I'm just like growing up and kind of, I mean, this is more like a Anita Wise counselor here. I mean, is this just how politics has always been? It's just, you know, everybody just goes with their gut?
I don't think, I think we have in the past had periods where there's sort of a rational dialogue. I do think that a lot of the issues around the presidency have been building up since Johnson, really, and this issue of power and the lack of willingness of the Congress to act. And you know, when you have Congress after Congress after Congress that's split so much, you tend to get used to not moving ahead on anything. And even the handful of times we've had the presidency and both houses in the same hands, They have been rendered ineffective by the tit for tat that goes on from the other side. You know, that's the problem with all the various rules in the Senate. So I suspect we'll see a few radical changes in how the Congress governs itself in the next couple of years, particularly if the Senate goes Democrat, which I actually don't think is likely at the moment. And if Trump were to lose, which I right now would not put money on. Notice I said I wouldn't put money. I didn't say I would put money on his winning. I just said I wouldn't put money on
his winning. I don't blame you. I wouldn't take that.
But I wouldn't put money on his losing either right now. So, you know, I think we've had worse periods. I think it is exceptional, the issue of COVID. This is the first event that has been truly experienced worldwide by every single living human being in this time period. And it will be the seminal event for your generation globally. And everyone younger than you. For my generation, Vietnam was the seminal event in the United States. And yes, there were places that joined in the protests in Europe and other places. And yes, we had protests over the Gulf Wars. And, you know, I remember being in Paris probably 20 years ago with my son, maybe 15 years ago, and at a dinner and with him. It was late night, and my wife, and there were two other French couples in the bistro. It was late, and this elderly couple came over, and they said, "Well, we know that. Are you Americans?" And we all sort of, yes, and expecting to be, you know, volleyed back and forth on the Gulf War or this or that. And they said, "Well, we like Americans. We remember World War II. We are Jews." And so that was a great lesson for my son in particular. But I don't think there is nothing in history that is like this disease that will leave an indelible mark on people everywhere, you know.
Would you?
And that's exceptionable. That's the issue. It's exceptional, and so it's hard to predict where things are going to go, Chris.
Yeah. Would you say that's true for everyone? Because, you know, being here in the Midwest on the South Side, surrounded by conservatives, you know, one Carmelite, the rich part of town on the North Side, he's a political pundit who deigned to come down to the South Side here and tweeted out, "It's like the Wild West down here. Nobody's wearing masks. Nobody expect a spike in 3 months." And I just tweeted back, and I'm going to go, "Dude, it's been like this the entire time. Nobody was wearing masks.
But
nobody
was socially." Your restaurants were closed.
Yeah, right.
Your businesses were closed. People lost their jobs. And that's true around the planet. You know, yeah. So my son's chef in Australia, they closed down 2 weeks behind us here. They actually opened up a week ahead of us here. They got it under control a little bit better. It will be a seminal event in his life. It was a great opportunity for him to see that he could, that he was resilient. You know, they basically closed down, created a huge business, a carryout business. And now they've iterated again. They're going to buy another restaurant kitchen, so they can continue going on with the carryout business and, you know, prep and everything. So there are going to be a lot of stories like that. And everybody will know somebody who died eventually. Maybe not. Maybe you won't. I don't actually know anybody personally who died, but I know people whose parents died.
Yeah.
And it's everywhere. It's sub-Saharan Africa. It's across the continent. It's every Asian country, every European country, Canada, you cannot name a place. I mean, even I haven't checked to see if Guam has had it. It would not surprise me because they have a fair amount of ship traffic. So
it's you know, in South America, for instance, really bad. Like they don't even have ventilators.
Pretending it's not.
Yeah.
Russia's the same.
I think you're right in that, you know, you take the example of my barber. It forever will probably change his perception of government power. You know,
I agree with that.
For some, it robbed him of something. Other people didn't have to follow the same rules, and it didn't affect him, so therefore the government, he'll never trust the government in the same, in the way that 9/11 was formational for me. I was a true believer through the Iraq War and then became completely disillusioned. And the Yellow Cake incident, for instance, completely forever changed how I view the federal government, how I view the government in general, and what information they give me. So I don't trust when I see John Bolton talking about this stuff. I am much more critical. So I do think, yeah, I think in that way, it's, I think it's massively changed the way that people think about their local government, think about their communities and their responsibility to communities. I think it's well, it is really
but
different.
But it's really good in a lot of ways about that, because it does underscore a couple things about our society. One is that we are extremely diverse. Two, and this is more important than anything else, that we really are, we are about as close government to people as you could possibly get. All of this stuff goes down to the governors. You know, Trump can say, I'm going to order this or that, and the governors say, well, try it. And then they try to tell the mayors and the county officials to do, and they say, well, try it. And some of the mayors have risen to the occasion, others have not. You know, it's like we were talking last time of Cuomo, I think kind of rose to the occasion. It's good for him, because there are a lot of people who didn't much like him because he was sort of dictatorial. Now they kind of like the fact that he was dictatorial on this. Well,
but then you hear about the nursing homes and you go, okay, maybe he.
Yeah. Why weren't they regulating those better? Yeah. Well, there you go. And of course you got to regulate them. Who fell down? What part of the swamp or the bureaucracy fell down there? But some mayors have responded incredibly well. I mean, this mayor of Atlanta seems to be quite well-spoken, and I don't know how effective she's been. It appears she's been relatively effective. Some governors are terrible. Some governors are lucky. You know, it's better to be bad and lucky probably than good and not, like some of them. You know, Newsom in California, I'd say in general, he's been both lucky and responsive and responsible. And so I think it underscores the distributed nature of government and institutions in this country, and how lucky we are in many respects not to have someone there who can wave a magic wand and say, we must all do this. You know, our institutions don't allow it.
Foreign Policy Magazine, part of the Council on Foreign Relations, or not Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs.
Foreign Affairs.
In their latest issue was arguing that federalism is the cause of much of the death in the United States, and that if the president had taken more power, then it could have been much more effectively handled, and it just shows how broken the system is. And I'm sitting here going, I'm really glad that we have a completely more dispersed system than other places, because if you have a German type system where they have a lot more control, or France, look at Spain versus Germany. You know, you want Donald Trump having more power than Donald Trump has.
Yeah. Well, and now it's worth underscoring again, these are not societies as diverse as our society.
Right.
Yes, they have a wall. They have now the influx of immigrants, but as societies, they are not very diverse. And it's true of the Germans, it's true of the Spaniards, it's true of the French. They have an immigration issue, but not they just don't have any diversity to speak of.
Yeah. So,
yeah. But I'm trying to remember who wrote that. As you know, I'm a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and speaking of the swamp.
Yes. I just my friend Pete Seat just got in, and I said, congratulations. I look forward to seeing you at the Bilderberg event.
Well, of course, that rings, you know, I'm sure I told you the story way back when about when George Bush was running the first time, and, you know, against Reagan and Connally and everybody else, and I was the issue director.
Yeah.
That he was attacked for being a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And what was the other one? It was
Trilateral Commission.
Trilateral Commission, totally establishment. So.
Yeah. It was the editor. It was the first one I got to, and I was just like, really? So predictable, Foreign Affairs. let's we got to wrap up, unfortunately, because I have a hard stop at around 3:30. So we always end with, you know, the Diner's Guide to DC. excuse me, great restaurants around DC. Do you have anything or anything that you're cooking that you're enjoying?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I went up to DC a couple of weeks ago to get a doctor's appointment and go get my hair cut, thank God. But so I haven't been doing many restaurants, so we don't have a lot of carry out around here the island. But what I do have an observation, which is, so I have been coming to this island, and this relates to food, believe it or not, for 65 years since I was a kid. And I've crabbed, I've fished, I've run up and down the beaches. I've lived, I've had this home for about 30 years and rebuilt it about 10 years ago. And, you know, it's kind of all glass. I can see all around me. And my wife and I sold our place in DC a year and a half ago and in theory moved down here lock, stock, and barrel full time, except we have now an apartment in DC because we couldn't really keep our toes out of the swamp. You know, I got to keep them cool. And we have a lot of business there and friends and all that. But the reality is I spent probably 2 days a week in Washington, all of that first 15 months. And my wife would do it the same. She had board meetings. I had board meetings, you know, this and that. So we were never really here to see the seasons change. And I really had this realization now that I've been stuck here for about 14 or 15 weeks. You know, I have a 300-foot dock. I walk out it every morning. I have three crab traps. And first time I put them in about a month ago, I didn't get anything for a day or two. And then I got one little crab. And then the next day I got a couple little crabs. And then I got a sort of a medium-sized crab. And then a medium-sized male crab and a female. So they were doing their thing. And she was a soft shell, so I hate to admit I took it and I ate it.
You brute.
But we've watched the crabs get bigger and bigger and more. And, you know, every day I get about a dozen and a half off the dock and I steam them. And some days I build them up and I pluck them. But I will say that my favorite is soft shell crabs. And I do some really great recipes. I do the standard sauteing, or sometimes with grilling. My favorite though is to take a soft shell crab, grill it quickly on both sides, and make a sauce with ginger cream and white port. Boil it down so you have this ginger cream sauce, and then you pour that on the crab and you top it with large capers that have been fried until they're crisp, and then sliced green onions, and it is to die for.
That sounds absolutely perfect.
it's delicious. and my mouth is watering.
I know.
I have to go get myself some soft shell crabs.
I
don't have a restaurant report, but come to my restaurant.
I'm going to. Yeah, I love crab, and you know I'm here landlocked in Indianapolis, and so like imitation crab is the closest you really can get, or frozen. Ooh. So you know, oh, that sounds so good. Yeah. I imagine it's got to be kind of nice to be a little stuck. I mean, that's one thing I've enjoyed about this is that you get stuck. I am not mad about being stranded a little bit for a couple months, because I realize like, oh, you know, now my motor's kind of back and I'm rested and I'm like, oh, I can't wait to get back to life. But, you know.
Well, I think the big problem is everybody thinks, at least they think somehow I'm supposed to be on vacation. But, you know, I get on these damn Zoom calls starting at 8:30 or 9 in the morning. I may have two or three on my calendar, and by the end of the day, I've had 10. Ugh. You know, it's like a bird with a mouth open. Feed me.
Yeah.
Stick a meeting in here.
You have one meeting. Oh, let's have a side meeting. Oh, I don't envy you. Dude. Yeah. For that.
Yeah. Well, you do something similar, I'm sure.
So. Yeah.
So I can't wait to get back to normal.
I know. Do you think it'll ever get back there?
Yeah, over time. I don't think people will be doing restaurants quite the way they'd like yet. One last thing, though, that they're doing in Australia that I think is brilliant is the government is limiting diners to 90 minutes, an hour and a half. Mm. And what that does, and the restaurateurs have to enforce it, what it does means that they can get three or four turns. So they may only be allowed 25% of their normal capacity, but if they can get three or four turns, they can make all the money they used to make. And again, my son has said in the last week, they made more money than they ever made.
Wow.
Because of the turns. And maybe we get some of these other local governments to do the same.
Hmm. Yeah. When your dining choices are Steak and Shake or Culver's, you don't typically stay for 90 minutes. So.
90 minutes you don't take.
No. All right. Okay. Well, it's been great to talk to you, and we'll have to do this in the next 2 or 3 weeks and not let it be a month. That's my fault. I apologize, and love talking to you.
We're both busy and we like doing it.
Yep. This is great. So thanks so much for joining us here on the program. Thank you to our patrons. And hey, if you need face masks, go to the Wall Store and click the link at WeAreLibertarians.com. Ooh. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you again soon.